We have made it to the last service of this year. Doesn't seem like we've been going for another year. This next, I guess Wednesday, I'll be here 3 years now, which kind of blows my mind as well. But we're here. How did you do this year? We always make plans at the beginning of the year. Well, now we're at the end of it. How did you do? Were you a better Christian this year than you have been in the past? Did you turn to God and pray to Him more than you did before? Were you more encouraging to others, like hopefully you plan to be this year? Did you acknowledge God more this year? Acknowledge His provisions, His protection, His love for you? Have you seen that, acknowledged it more than you have? Were you as bold this year to talk to others and teach others, like hopefully we all plan to do? There's some things that I had planned to do this year spiritually that I don't think I've met my goal with. And I've got to be real with myself about that. But there are some things I hope that we can all see that we have been better at as we've gone through this year. You know, as Christians, it should be our goal to be better every year, to be better every day, really. Just a little bit better of a servant, as we're reminded in Bible class this morning. We're not here to serve ourselves, but to serve God. But sometimes, even though we are good people, we are godly people, we sometimes don't always do, and that didn't even make sense, we don't always do what God asks us to do, as good a people as we are. And this morning I want us to talk about Jonah. Jonah, I'll admit, is one that I've had him wrong in my mind for many years. And the more I studied about Jonah, we find out that he's not as horrible of a person as I put in my mind. Jonah was actually a prophet. Jonah was a servant who, like I was just describing, he allowed his feelings, his thoughts, his emotions on something to keep him from obeying God. And therefore he ended up sinning against Him, as we'll see this morning. If you're not already there in the book of Jonah, go ahead and turn over there. We're going to be looking at what Ty just read there. If you're not there, if you can't have a hard time finding Jonah, it's between Obadiah and Micah. I'm sure that helps everyone out a bit. I was kind of wondering what Ty's face was going to be when I said, hey, turn to Jonah. He didn't even flinch. He's there. But these are those weird passages. It's funny, somebody, ironically, this week referred to these as the Star Wars books of the Bible. You've got your Obadiah, your Micah, your Obi-Wans, your Habakkuk, and your Chewbaccas. All these things that are weird names. I'm glad that we don't have names like that today. But we're going to be looking at Jonah. My goal is maybe once a month for the next few months. There's so many lessons in the book of Jonah. I'm going to try to revisit Jonah a few times in the next few months. This morning, we're just going to be looking at those first 16 verses or so. But as always, whenever we open up God's Word, I want us to again, as Charles mentioned, let's look at ourselves. Let's see, even though we look at Jonah in a certain way, or I have, maybe we have Jonah inside of us. God told Jonah to go out and try to share salvation with these people who are about to be destroyed. And that's exactly what God asks of us, to go out and try to offer salvation to those who are lost. But like Jonah, do we allow our feelings, our insecurities, our worries and doubts, maybe our own judgment on others, to keep us from obeying God's commandment? Are we Jonah? And as the title suggests, don't be Jonah. We may be what we look down on in Him. Let's get right into verse 1. We've got a lot of ground to cover this morning. Back in verse 1, it says, "The word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, 'Arise and go to Nineveh.'" I want to stop right there. If we're going to study Jonah, we need to believe in Jonah. We need to understand who Jonah is. Most of the time, if anybody knows anything about Jonah, they say, well, Jonah said no to God about something, and so he fled from God, and God put him in the belly of the fish. And he lived there for 3 days. And then they stop right there and say, this couldn't be a true story because no one could possibly live in a fish for 3 days. But we got to remember that there's more to that story than that. I would say that of all this would not make the top 10 of my list of things that are hard to believe in the Bible. You look at Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, and you see that God, with a few words, put our whole universe and life into existence. You look at passages like Luke chapter 2, and you see where God the Son comes and is born as a human baby. leaving heaven to come down to here, to live among men, to grow and to do these things on earth, and while he's here, to raise the dead, to heal the sick, and to do all kinds of miracles. I may have already said raising the dead. And then you see later in his life that he didn't commit any sin, but God was willing to suffer for those who reject him, to die on a cross, and then to raise himself up from the dead. And you think that a God that created all of this and that did all these and is able to forgive sins can't keep a man alive in a fish for a few days? There's a lot more harder things to believe than what we see here in Jonah. And some may say, okay, well, I'll follow that. The Bible's inspired and so forth, but this is more like a parable, not a real story. But there's a lot of problems with that. When we look at parables, parables talk in generalities, in well-known common generalities that people, you don't have to explain these because they're so clear and understandable. It doesn't mention names and things like that, but here in Jonah we say we've got specific names, we've got specific time frames, we've got specific details that are there. As we just read there, verse 1 specifically says, Jonah, the son of Amittai. That's pretty specific there. And so we have specific things. It doesn't say once upon a time there was some man who didn't have a name, because his name's not important because this isn't a real story. It says this is his name, this is his father. And that's not the only place that we read about here. Over in 2 Kings, we see that we have jumps in the Bible where they're tying together different things. And here in 2 Kings, in chapter 14, verse 25, it says, "The Lord, the God of Israel, spoke through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was of Gath-Hepher." And we'll talk about that here in just a second. There's a specific place. Gath-Hepher is just to the west of the Sea of Galilee. Maybe west, southwest. It's not too far from there. And this is a specific place you can find, just as we'll talk about with Nineveh. But what's even more interesting that is Jesus talked about Jonah. Jesus talked about Nineveh as historical places, but not just some guy, but Jesus several times, as you go ahead and turn over to Matthew chapter 12, talks about Jonah and how Jonah is a prophetic sign of himself and his own ministry. Why would Jesus pick somebody that's a nobody to try to prove who he is? In Matthew chapter 12, beginning of verse 38, it says there, "Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered him," that is Jesus, "saying, Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." Verse 38 says, "But he answered and said to them, An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign shall be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh shall stand up with this generation at the judgment, and shall condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here." As you look at Luke chapter 11, verses 29 and 30, we see another very similar passage to this. There again, verse 29, "And the crowds were increasing, or as the crowds were increasing, he began to say, This generation is a wicked generation. It seeks for a sign, and yet no sign shall be given to it but the sign of Jonah. For just as Jonah became a sign to the Ninevites, so shall the Son of Man be to this generation." Jonah is not just some made-up story. Like I said, why would Jesus pick something that is weak and non-existent to prove that he is real and very much alive? That he is powerful? You wouldn't pick something like that. You'd pick another common thing with that. And so Jonah was alive. Nineveh was real, just as God is real today. And so we need to believe in Jonah as we enter into this study. He's not just some fictitious story, just a good thing that we read about and gives the teacher something to talk about in the kids' class. He's real and he teaches us many, many lessons. As you continue into verse 2, we also find out more about Nineveh. And this is where, again, I've proven my own thoughts wrong as I've studied this more, and my understanding of why things went the way that they did. In verse 2 it says, again, the Lord is talking to Jonah. He says, "Rise and go to Nineveh, a great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me." There's two things that we need to know about Nineveh right now. We'll learn more later on, Lord willing, as we go into the book more. But one, there, as it says, a great city. This city is huge, but also it's very extremely wicked. Let's first look at how huge it was. In Jonah chapter 3 and verse 3, we're told that it takes 3 days for someone to walk from one side of Nineveh to the other side. Again, we think of things in how many miles is it? Well, let's just add a minute for that because it takes that long in a car. But again, walking across this, as we'll see Jonah does later on, it takes 3 days to go all the way across this. The very last verse of the book of Jonah tells us also that there are over 120,000 people here. God says that himself. And so this is a pretty big place here. Historians tell us that the walls around Nineveh were wide enough where 3 chariots side by side could drive across and all around the wall. So it's not just some tiny little wall. It was a big town. It had a big wall. It was needed in order to protect that. Nineveh is said to be the flourishing capital of the Assyrian Empire. And again, when you talk about big cities and you talk about empires and things like that, capital cities, they come with very big and extravagant architecture. And for that time, they had that. They had the culture. They had the best of the entertainment. All these things, you kind of start seeing a picture there of what kind of town that Nineveh actually was. But like I said, sometimes with large cities, you also have very wicked cities. And Nineveh was one of the worst. Of that time, they are said to be some of the cruelest people in the world during that time. Nineveh's history, they don't try to hide how cruel they were. They bragged and boasted about how wicked and, or not wicked, but how cruel they were to others and how, what such great soldiers and victors they were in things. And here's some pictures that I have come across from Nineveh and the things that they do describing this, kind of hieroglyphic kind of stuff, pictures about what kind of people they were. When they conquered a people, they would skin them alive, the men, the women, and the children. They would then take their skin and they would hang it across the wall, down the wall and across the wall. So they basically had a skin-covered wall from all those who they had skinned. They would take these people who were skinned and still alive, and they would bury them in the sand up to their heads. At that time, they'd take their tongues and they'd pull their tongues out and they would stake them into the ground so they couldn't pull their tongues back. So these people are in extreme agony because they have no skin left and they've got dirt all over it. They can't pull their tongue out because there's a spike in the middle of it, so they can't close their mouth, and they're dying of thirst and extreme anguish at the same time. They would also take the women and rape them and murder them many times. They would do unmentionable things to the children. And that's not all of it. You look at other accounts and we see that they would take the enemy soldiers while they were still alive and they would impale them on the gates and let them die that way. Then you have other times where they would take those and they would cut their heads off and they would make a big mountain of heads outside the city walls. And they would say, this is what comes of those who oppose Nineveh and oppose Syria. As you look at who the greatest, the main target of the Assyrians was throughout the Old Testament, you find out that it was their neighbors to the south, the Israelites. Is it any wonder why Jonah would not want to go and offer salvation to that? It kind of changes your mind and your thinking process, or does for me. Because do you think he was affected by these Assyrians and these people of Nineveh? Did he lose family members and loved ones, fellow believers? I don't know. We're not specifically told that, but it's a very large possibility. These were not just people he didn't like. These were his enemies. These are those who he was likely afraid to even go into and try to save. Does it paint a better picture as to why he did the things that he did? We look at him, but I can understand it. It doesn't justify that he disobeyed God and he fled from God. But I can understand a little bit better about why he would wanted to run a different way. I don't know. It's hard for us to wish the best for those that hurt us the worst. And I can imagine how bad he and his family and those around him had been hurt by these people. And he's told to go and save these people. I don't know, it does a whole lot for me, because sometimes that's exactly what we're asked to do. We're not to hate our enemies, we're to love our enemies. We're trying to save those who are lost. And that might be very painful for us to do. As we look in verse 3, we again see the reaction that Jonah has to God telling him to go and to help these wicked people. Again, verse 3 says, "But Jonah rose up to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. So he went down to Joppa and found a ship which was going to Tarshish, paid the fare, and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord." God clearly told Jonah what he was supposed to do. There was no doubt in there. We talked about Cain and Abel, and did they know what they were supposed to do? Yeah, they did. Just as Jonah knew exactly what he was supposed to do, but he chose to not do it. I'm going to flee. I'm going to go away from this. And you know, again, as a child, I read this and I say, okay, well, he probably just went down to another town. He just went the other direction, went a little bit away. Jonah didn't just try to get a little bit away. Jonah tried to go as far away from here as he possibly could. Jonah went off the map, literally, as you look at our, what we call our Bible maps. Again, you look up here, you can see where Nineveh is. Now, he was supposed to go up to Nineveh, so I'm not going to say those 550 miles were where he was at. Again, the place he was at is Gath Hepher, and I don't know if you can see it on the map here or not. Again, the Sea of Galilee is right here, and so it would be right here, probably at the end of the arrow, is where he is from, as 2 Kings tells us. Well, even from there, it's about 60 miles to Joppa, where we're told that he got on a boat. He was trying to go all the way to Tarshish. That's past Italy and Rome and all that. He's trying to go all the way to Spain. That's where Tarshish is. Some 2,500 miles away. That's what he wants to do. I don't want to just get away from here. I want to get as far away from here as I possibly can. And we look at that and we look at the extremes and all. We don't do that for ourselves. And we'll talk about that here more in just a second. But like I said, growing up, I just thought that Jonah was a terrible, terrible person. Why would God ask him to do anything if this is the way that he responds to God? But like I said, we've got to remember, first and foremost, Jonah was a prophet. He was a servant of God. And his example is mentioned as the kind of servant he was. He was a great servant. And he did all these things, but in this one instance, it's the only time that we see that he disobeyed God in any way. So what kind of a person is he? Well, he's us. And again, we can look at each other, we can judge other people and judge our godliness, comparing it to someone else's godliness or their lack of godliness. And we can make ourselves feel better about it. But Romans 3:23 tells us that we've all sinned, we've fallen short of the glory of God. At one point or another, we've all sinned. We've all rebelled against God. And that's what I want us to remember. Stop comparing yourself to others and remember that rebellion is simply saying no to God. And that's exactly what Jonah did in this one instance. We don't know a whole lot about what else he did in his life, but we know what he did at this one time. Kind of stinks that he was a prophet and such a great servant, as we can see. And then what's focused on the most, and have a whole book about how he disobeyed God and his bad attitudes. Again, there's good parts in that as well, him turning back and repenting and so forth. But he still had attitude issues as he went along. But it's easy for us to compare in that same way. We can say, well, I go to church more than you do. And we say, well, that's other people in the world. No, that's people in the church that have said that. I know for a fact, since I've been here, there has been one group at least that I'm aware of that looked and said, well, this congregation only meets once on Sunday, and another one worships twice. And so they must be more holy, and I'm going to worship with them. I'm going to drive through this town, and I'm going to worship with them because they worship more. And that's Christian talk. How many times are Christians hypocrites in their thinking, in their actions, and in their words? We all fall short, but we need to be open with ourselves. And again, look and see, am I Jonah? Do we look at how much we give? Well, I bet I give more than them. I bet I have a better attitude towards them. I'm more benevolent than they are in this, that, and the other. We can make all kinds of different things. But it would be easy for us to do the same thing with Jonah. Well, I've not rebelled against God. I've not turned around and tried to go 2,500 miles away from God when He told me to do something. Like I said, we've all sinned. We've all fallen short. We've all done that. Rebellion is simply saying no. God told me to do this, but I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And so we've got to look out for that. I'm afraid there's more godly people than we like to admit, who have this same attitude in themselves. And they may look like they're doing everything they're supposed to, but they're saying no to God in some way or another. And again, there's so many ways we can do that. We can have this attitude of, well, I'm going to trust in and I'm going to hold on to these things of life more than I do for God. Maybe we hold on to relationships that we know are not pleasing to God, but we just want to hold on to them so much. Maybe we're not giving as we should. We're not as loving to our enemies as we should. We're not as encouraging as we are told to be. Maybe we don't use our time in the way that God tells us to do that. There's so many different aspects. That's just a few of them. But maybe we are just like Jonah, in that in some area or another, we have said no. And it doesn't mean we had to shout it out at the top of our voices. We can just whisper and say no. We can sit there and do nothing and say no in some areas. And so we've got to open up our eyes to who we really are and not try to lie to ourselves. It's not going to help us or anyone else if we do that. Something else that I noticed in verse 3 that was very interesting is you notice that Jonah, whenever he went to Joppa, he found a ship that was ready to go to Tarshish. And I want to think about that idea of finding a ship that's ready. How many times have you heard of people who find a ship that's ready, quote unquote, and they say, well, that must be God working. I found a ship. I wanted to do something, and I found a ship that was ready to go, and so that must be God working and saying that it's okay for me to do that. And we justify ourselves because we were able to do that. Let me get in my notes here a second. I'm all over the place. Situations, again, trying to justify what we want to do. You know, we say things like, but can't you see how everything has worked out? Didn't you see how this all came together in such a perfect way? That must be God. That must be God's work. People use this for adultery all the time. I was miserable in my marriage. And so God wanted me to be happy. And so he put this person in my life so that I could be happy. That was God. I've heard that more times than I can tell you. But I can assure you, God did not put someone in your life to break up your marriage just because it'll make you happy. That is foolish talk for us to try to justify our sin by saying that God did that and put this ship there for me to get on. That's ridiculous. Yes, God wants us to be happy, but it's like we sometimes forget that God's not the only one who's working on us. Again, as Charles prayed, Satan is working on us, and we can't forget that. God wants us to be happy, but if we want to follow Satan, we're going to follow Satan. If we allow our eyes to wander, guess what? There's always going to be somebody there to flirt back with us, to offer up that opportunity to be unfaithful. If we want to get out of our marriage, there's always going to be some too-good-to-be-true relationship that's there for us. You can find it. If we let greed and things like that into our lives and to stay in our lives, there's always going to be something that's too good to pass up, some deal, some way to get ahead or to commit fraud against somebody. There's always ways to do it. There's a ship ready for us in whatever sin we want to pursue. It's there. And we need to stop saying that that's God that's doing there, or that, that God's the one that put it there. But the other thing is, we also sometimes make the excuse, well, I had peace in my heart about this. I made this decision, and I'm at peace with it. And like that somehow saying that God says it's okay now, don't worry about everything that I wrote down in my word, but because you have a peace in your heart, that means it's okay. We've got to get past that as well. In Genesis chapter 3, we are reminded, again, that's exactly what Satan does. When he's tempting Eve, he's trying to say, you know, be at peace with going against God. Oh, sure, it's okay. That forbidden tree, it's actually good for you. It's going to make you wise. No, you're not going to die from it. And so he tried to give her peace in her sin. And that's exactly what she bought. She wanted it. She desired it. He said, the ship's here. The peace is here. Go for it. And that's exactly what she bought into. And so we've got to be careful about, just because we have peace in our heart about something, that means that God's approving of it. We need to turn to God and His Word, because that's what doesn't change at all throughout time. As you continue in verses 4 and 5, we see that that Jonah is given a I guess you could say, a rude wake-up call as he's on this ship. Beginning in verse 4, "And the Lord said," or the Lord rather, "hurled a great wind on the sea, and there was a great storm on the sea, so that the ship was about to break up. Then the soldiers became afraid, and every man cried to his God, and they threw the cargo which was on the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone below into the hold of the ship, lain down and fallen sound asleep." You know the problem with running away from God? It's because God's already at where you're running to. You can't run away from God regardless of how hard you try. And Jonah found that out very quickly. As he leaves Joppa and heads for Tarshish, God makes it very clear very quickly how upset he is with Jonah. And so he sends this huge storm to him. And as it says there, it's about to tear the ship apart. That's the kind of storm, right? We're not just talking about a little bit turbulent water. We're talking about this is something bad. I think about this as I read this. I think about Jesus being asleep down in the ship and everyone's terrified. It's the same kind of situation, which again, the comparison between Jonah and Jesus is there again. If I had more time, we could get into that. But anyway, it's not pertinent with what we're talking about right now. But what do you see the sailors doing here? All of his crewmates here, whenever the storm is going crazy, we see their first thing is to let's pray to our God. And so while they're up there praying to their God and talking to each other about their gods, which I believe they did because that's the first thing that they asked to Jonah here in just a second. They're talking about gods. They're talking about religion. They're praying to God. But then what else do you have? You have the prophet of the true living God, and he's downstairs asleep. I find that quite ironic because how many times has that happened to us? Those in the world who we would say are lost based on what we can see from their fruit, how many times are they talking about God? How many religious conversations are they having? But do we shy away? Do we go to our own people because it's easy to be a Christian around Christians? But we won't have those same religious conversations. You know, the whole reason he's here is because God told him to go and teach others, and he said no. Well, now he's sleeping below. And again, there's a whole study that I was doing about what the word sleep here means. It's the same sleep that you see with that God put Adam in whenever he took the rib out of him. Anyway, a whole another story. Like I said, I've cut this lesson in half. So when we get done late, I want you to be thankful for that. There's so many things there. But he's asleep. I hope that doesn't describe us. While the world is talking about religious things, I hope we're involved in that. And we're not hiding off. But have you noticed, ever since Jonah rebelled against God, what has happened to his life? You see the word down happening a whole lot with Jonah here. Because he decided to rebel against God, his life has gone nowhere but down. In verse 3 it says he went down to Joppa, and I know some of these are just coincidental words. But then he also went down into the ship. Verse 5 says he went down into the lowest parts of the ship. He went down to sleep. You talk about him being down in the belly of the fish and all these different things. There's lots of downs here. His life is not going up at all, is my point in this. As you look at chapter 2 and verse 3, actually you look at several verses here, verses 2, verse 3, looking at what Jonah does, as he's praying to God, he says in verse 3, "You cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the flood surrounded me. All your billows and your waves passed over me." In verse 6, it says, "I descended into the roots of the mountain, the earth with its bars closed behind me forever." And like I said, there's many more passages like that, but you get the point. None of these things are positive things. But isn't that exactly what sin does? Sin is not going to do positive things for us. Again, it may make us think positive things are happening, but sin is going to send us in our life into a downward spiral. We may not see it at first. Like I said, we may think that God supports our decision. We may think that we're at peace. But in reality, we're leading to spiritual death and destruction. That's what sin does, and that's exactly what's happening here in Jonah's life. We've got to be open to the realities and the costs of what sin really does to us and stop trying to fool ourselves into thinking that we can run from God or from His punishments. It's not going to happen. And God is making that very clear to Jonah at this time. He needs to wake up and he needs to do something right. And so as we look at verses 6 through 10, We're again reminded, just as we were last week, that sin doesn't just affect us. Maybe 2 weeks ago we talked about this. Sin and our disobedience affects others. Beginning in verse 6, it says, "So the captain approached him and said, 'How is it that you're sleeping? Get up and call on your God. Perhaps your God will be concerned about us so that we will not perish.' And each man said to his mate, 'Come, let us cast lots so we may learn on whose account this calamity has struck us.' So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, 'Tell us now, on whose account has this calamity struck us? What is your occupation, and where did you come from? What is your country, from what people are you?' And he said to them, 'I'm a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land.' Then the men became extremely frightened, and they said to him, 'How could you do this?' For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord, because he had told them." Like I said, I think 2 weeks ago we talked about Achan, and how so many people, all of his family, his livestock, all of his possessions were destroyed because of his decision, because of his disobedience. When God said, "You don't take anything from here," and he said, "But I want to," and he said no to God. Just as Jonah said no to God, just as we say no to God when we sin. And because of that, Achan's family suffered, and here all the soldiers are paying emotionally for Jonah's sin, in that they're afraid for their life. Again, our disobedience, our rebellion, our sin is also going to affect others. Just ask anyone who's had a loved one who has fallen away. I think pretty much everybody in this room has been affected by some loved one who is no longer faithful. Tell me how that affects you. It's heartbreaking. It nearly destroys you when your loved one has chosen to say no to God. You all suffer for it. And not just that person, but what I want us to think about, as painful and as hurtful as it is, if you have been hurt by someone else because of them saying no to God, how much have others suffered because of you? Because you said no to God, you disobeyed, you were the rebellious one, and you sinned. And how much heartbreak and maybe even physical discomfort many have suffered because of you. That's where it gets painful. And I think if we all realize what sin really was and what it's going to cost us both now and especially in eternity, maybe we wouldn't be so quick to sin as maybe we sometimes are. I think there's some interesting things that are worth noting as we see the crew responding to the action, the things that are happening right now. What's the first thing that the crew did whenever they noticed something was wrong? Well, the first thing we see them did is they turned to their so-called gods for help. Even though they weren't the real God, the first place they turned was to God, their God. The second thing they did is they realized quickly that the reason this was happening is because of sin. Not always the case, but here they said, "This is sin." And the third thing they did is, "I want to find out," and there was urgency in trying to find out where that sin had come from. And the fourth thing that they did is they were willing to do whatever was necessary to purge that sin from among them. They saw how it was going to destroy them, and so they talked to their God, they acknowledged the sin, they looked for the sin, and they were willing to do what was necessary to get rid of it. These are pagan people here. These are sailors, which in our time don't have the greatest reputation of being godly people. But that's what they did. Shouldn't that be the exact same thing that we do as God's children? To acknowledge Him, to acknowledge sin, to find it and do whatever we can to get rid of it. I think we can learn some things through that. But the greatest thing that we can do is to be close to God. The greatest love, the greatest gift I can offer to my wife and my kids, my neighbors, to all of you as brothers and sisters, is to be close to God. Yes, I do it because God says, "Be close to me, love me, obey me," and so forth. One, because I know that I'm going to be judged based on that, but also because I know that if I'm close to God, you're going to benefit from that. And if you're close to God, I'm going to benefit from that. If we're all close to God, we're all going to grow and benefit from that. And that's what we need to be all striving for. You know, I haven't flown in a plane for several years now, but all the times that I've flown in the past, I don't think this has changed. The flight attendant goes through their spiel, and one of the things is, in case of an emergency, the oxygen masks are going to come down from the ceiling. What do they tell you to do with it? They say, you put it on yourself first, and then you help other people. Why do they do that? Because they need to make sure that you're able to breathe so that you can become the helper and not become the problem. And I think there's some spiritual application that we need to learn from that. We need to make sure that we get our oxygen mask on spiritually and then get busy helping out others as well. Because there may be a time that our oxygen runs out and we need somebody to help us and so forth. It's a mutual relationship. But if we choose not to put on our mask in the first place, we're going to die. And other people are going to be lost as well. Same thing goes spiritually. We've got to make sure we take care of our things and not try to act like it doesn't exist or that it's not happening. As we finish the last several verses, verses 11 through 16, we see that they've got to make a decision at this point about what they're going to do. How are we going to move forward from this? We know what happened. We know who's the problem. What are we going to do about it? Verse 11, they said to him, to Jonah, what shall we do to you that the sea may become calm for us? For the sea was becoming increasingly stormy. And he said to them, pick me up and throw me into the sea. Then the sea will become calm for you, for I know that on account of me, this great storm has come upon you. However, the men rowed desperately to return to land, but they could not, for the sea was becoming even stormier against them. Then they called to the Lord and said, we earnestly pray, O Lord, do not let us perish on account of this man's life, and do not put innocent blood on us, for thou, O Lord, hast done as thou hast pleased. So they picked up Jonah, threw him into the sea, and the sea stopped its raging. And the men feared the Lord greatly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. Again, Jonah and the men are all at the same understanding now that sin is to blame. And they've got to decide here, are we going to fight against this storm? Are we going to try to do everything we can to try to do this ourselves? Or are we going to yield to the storm? Are we going to stop fighting against this? Are we going to submit to God? And we see, at first they didn't do what they should have done. They tried to row as hard as they could, but guess what? God said, you row harder, I'm going to push harder. And the storm grew and grew, and they finally realized how futile it is to try to fight against God, to fight against the storm that comes from disobedience. And so eventually they submitted to him, they prayed to him, and they threw Jonah overboard. It may be that we are in that same boat right now. We're in the same boat as Jonah, and the storm is coming. The storm is raging, and we got to decide, you know what, am I going to keep fighting against God? Am I going to try to keep hiding my sin or denying that I even have sin? Am I going to hold on to that peace in my heart or assume that that ship that showed up that I jumped on was God? Or am I going to submit to God and say, you know what, I have sinned against you? And that's exactly what Jonah did. He didn't try to say, well, I don't know, it may be me. I'm not. No, he said, nope, it's me. I'm the problem. Throw me overboard. This will all end if you do that. And eventually that's exactly what they did. They prayed to God. And so they stopped fighting against God and they submitted to him. That's exactly what we've got to do. If they had kept fighting against God, against the storm, they'd have all died. And that's what we may do to others. We may take others down with us, because the longer we fight against God, the harder our heart's going to be, the more we're going to be abrasive against what he wants us to do. And we can that is contagious. Like we talked about in Bible class this morning. You go and you start bad-mouthing certain things and this and so forth, and then by the time we're done with it, well, it's the church's fault. I don't want to go to church anymore because somebody hurt me. That's you. That's not God. God never changed. His word never changed. That's all a heart issue. But if we want to find salvation, we've got to stop fighting against God. We've got to submit to him. And it may be painful to do so, but that's what's required. But the saddest thing about this whole thing is none of this had to happen. Nobody had to suffer at all if Jonah had just said, yes, God, I will do that. I don't want to do it. You do understand how bad I'm hurting. And God understood how bad he was hurting, how bad the Israelites were hurting. But he said, there's souls here that are lost. And as he talks about there in chapter 4, are they not worth it? Are these 120,000 people who don't know their left hand from their right hand, is their soul not worth salvation instead of destruction? We've got to see that in ourselves as well. Again, the book of Jonah reminds us so many different things. It reminds us that we don't have to be completely engulfed in worldliness to rebel and sin against God. It's just one word, no. It's just one action that says no. And so we've got to remember that. Remember, Jonah was a prophet and a servant of God. And if he can do the same thing, and so many huge things happen because of that, the same can be for us as well. We've got to stop fighting and turn back to God. Another thing that he reminds us, again, we've kind of mentioned it throughout the lesson, is our responsibility to others. He was told to go and teach to people who are difficult to teach to. Are we willing to do the same thing? Are we going to aggressively and actively teach? Or are we just going to do what we've done in years past and go, I'll say something if someone asks me. Someone says, are you a Christian? I'll say yes. If they ask me the questions, I'll try to answer them the best I can. Or are we going to go and try to teach? God told him, you go teach. They don't want the message. They're not asking for the message, but they need the message. So you go teach them. Are we doing that same thing? Or are we, again, like I said before, we're going back to our comfort of our people. And we're content with Sunday mornings and Wednesday nights being Christians. If our boldness is only here, then we're not bold. We're cowards. And again, that's I'm not saying that to you, I'm saying that to me. We've all got to step up. We got a new year, a new opportunity in front of us to do that. If you've got storms in your life because you've said no to God, they're there for a purpose. Those storms aren't there to destroy us. They're there to bring us back. They're there to restore us, not to destroy us. And so this morning, if you've got something in your life, some no that you've said to God, some hidden sin as we talked about the other day, something in your life where you're not doing what God wants you to do, now's a great time to make your life right with God. But you've got to turn to Him. If we can help you this morning, why don't you come as together we stand and sing.
Three prize.